This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 50, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast, and it looks into evidence of the afterlife. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. And this week I'm talking to Kelly Chase about her book, The UFO Rabbit Hole, Book 1. Kelly is the host of the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast. She's passionate about leveraging her skills and expertise to support the UFO disclosure movement. Hi Kelly, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So we're going to talk about your book and other stuff. The book's called The UFO Rabbit Hole, Book 1. I wanted to ask, how did this all start for you? You had a UFO sighting when you were quite young?
I did. I had a sighting when I was probably 13 years old, and I was on vacation with my family and out in the Outer Banks, North Carolina. And I was sitting alone outside looking up at the sky, and it was so weird because I remember distinctly beforehand. And I had never had this thought before, but I had this distinct feeling that if I looked up at that moment that I would see a UFO. And it wasn't even something I was particularly interested in at the time. And I looked up and I saw this light moving very quickly across the sky, and it made a right turn and then another right turn and then just shot off faster than anything I've ever seen. And so I remember being very puzzled because I knew that a plane couldn't make right angle turns like that, and that a meteor couldn't make right angle turns like that, and a plane couldn't move that fast. I was like, what was that? But I went in and told my family. I think they accused me of maybe smoking something, and I actually almost got in trouble basically for reporting this because they thought that I was misbehaving outside. And so I kind of just let it go for years and years. And it wasn't until in the last couple of years that with everything that kind of came out in the United States with, you know, them talking and about UFOs finally and admitting that, like, yes, we see them, we're not sure what they are, that suddenly it kind of sucked me back in and started this whole unraveling for me.
And I find it interesting you say that it's like you had a feeling that you would see a UFO. It's that kind of consciousness thing or telepathic thing that we hear about with UFOs and ETs, that maybe they did influence you. They wanted you to see them.
Yeah, I've always wondered because, like I said, it wasn't, as a kid, I was interested in a lot of different paranormal type things, but for some reason, UFOs never really made it on my radar in that way. So it was a weird thought for me to have, and then to have that like immediate payoff. It's something that's definitely always stuck with me.
Yeah, it's like they wanted to lead you down a path, but they can do stuff over decades. They're not like they're trying to get you going right now. You were saying that you had no idea what the craft were, but when you saw this stuff, these videos that were released, it shook you to your core?
Yeah, well, what happened was actually, so I can be not proud of this, but it's a sad fact about me is that I'm a bit of a workaholic. And so I was going on vacation in 2021 in the spring with my family. And we were actually going back to the Outer Banks where I saw that UFO. And so I'd sort of been thinking about that. And then I started to kind of pay attention to more of the news stories that had been out for a while, but I just hadn't really thought much of them. And I was going to be bored on this vacation. I'm not used to unplugging and taking time off. And so I was like, my activity for the week is I'm going to get to the bottom of the UFO phenomenon. I'm going to figure the whole thing out and we're going to square this away in a week. And obviously that was not the experience that I had, but I spent that week kind of acquainting myself with what had been going on in the government and over the last few years. And it just opened up the rabbit hole for me in a way that I just really haven't come back from. It became an obsession in that week. And you know, as you were saying, I have felt sort of led through this experience. After I had been into it for about a few months of really kind of exploring and going deep and realizing that there was something much more profound here, even than just UFOs, that there were implications about the nature of our reality and of consciousness and what it means to be a human and, you know, our place in the cosmos and these like really profound questions. So I started really devoting myself to study. And one morning on a Saturday, random Saturday, I was just sitting cross-legged on my bed in my room, and I had this really overwhelming, almost conversion experience. I had been up to that point in my life an atheist and a strict materialist. I didn't believe in anything woo, and I had a lot of kind of scorn for people who did, I'm sad to say now. But in that moment, it was probably the best way I can describe it is it was like the most intense psychedelic experience of my life that was condensed down into probably only like 2 minutes. But for me, it felt like forever. And I'm still really having a hard time more than a year later articulating what I saw or what happened to me. But I came out of that experience knowing very clearly that there is a God, that there is something much bigger than myself, that we are connected, that we are love, you know, all these cliches I'd heard people talk about. I went from not believing it could possibly be real to knowing in my soul that it absolutely was, because I had seen it. And out of that experience also came sort of the outline for the podcast itself. It came to me, and I guess people would call it a download now. I didn't know what it was at the time. But it came to me very rapidly and ended up outlining the whole podcast that day, which has been a really interesting experience because that was really early on in my studies. And it's interesting how faithful I've been to that outline. It's just interesting to me that I was able to write an outline that was so much the path that I wanted to take at that time. It's been very interesting to watch it unfold. But really what I also came out of with that experience was a sense is that, so I'm a marketer by trade. I'm a brand director for an e-com company. And I've really sort of been a student of messaging and storytelling and how to get a message out in, you know, the noise of our really saturated digital lives. And I was just suddenly overwhelmed with this feeling that what I wanted to do was to create a podcast that was an on-ramp to these topics for people like me, for the people like I had been. So somebody who was approaching this like, I believe in science, and so this can't possibly be true. And just really taking it step by step and showing people that there is something here. And the reason that it doesn't make sense isn't because all of these things aren't true, but because our models of reality are broken, which is ultimately where the podcast is going. So that's a very long-winded answer, but it's been a really interesting and intense journey for me.
What I found with people that I've interviewed in both my podcasts, who may be scientists and have that kind of atheist materialist background, is that when they really do take the time to investigate this stuff, their minds are changed and they think, hang on a second, there really is something going on here. And it's really the materialists can sort of throw it away so easily, and almost a sort of thing as saying, don't bother telling me about it. I already know it's rubbish.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was a very humbling experience for me to be so wrong, to be so, so sure and so arrogant in my belief that I was right, to then go and look and say, actually, although I considered myself to be a very logical thinker, and, you know, believed in science, what I didn't, I failed to recognize in myself that I had, my entire belief structure was a house of cards that was built upon not even a shaky foundation, but no foundation. You know, materialism really requires that you assume a few miracles first to even make it work. You know, you have to believe that life somehow arose out of inert matter, even though we have no idea why. You have to explain why there's something instead of nothing, because statistically it doesn't make sense. And there's so many things that are kind of at the basis of, but like I said, that it's not even that foundation of materialism is shaky. It doesn't exist. It's floating on a cloud somewhere, and the second you recognize it, it all falls apart.
And have there been things in your research that you've come across and they've just been too far out for you, but then later getting more information from other places, you think, oh, hang on a second, maybe that isn't too far out.
Yes. All the time. I have been deeply, deeply humbled in that way, to the point that I can say that at this point, I don't know that anything is too far out for me. That's not where I started. At the beginning, there were all kinds of things that I absolutely would not consider. But I had sort of an awareness maybe about 9 months ago that where things really changed for me, where I started to recognize and started to feel guilty, because I was like, I can't just take this from a nuts and bolts perspective. I can't just look at the phenomenon itself and, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I couldn't just continue to ignore the accounts of experiencers. Like, how can I be advocating for the idea that this is a real phenomenon and it exists, but then continue to, I guess, participate in the stigmatization of experiencers by not taking their experiences seriously. And so I really had to kind of take a step back and look at a lot of things again. And also it forced me to go back to the science and to understand, to start to understand a framework in which I could start to understand other people's experiences. And so long story short, at this point, I will consider anything. And I think that it's actually a really healthy way to approach this topic, or really any topic, is that, you know, just because you consider something doesn't mean you believe it. Just because you examine something doesn't mean you've internalized it. And I don't think we should be afraid to look at things. And so many of the things that I said, that's too far, I wouldn't ever believe in that, you know, I look at now. And I think that's been a really, really good experience for me, not just in this realm, but I think just as a human in general, to go through that sort of intellectual humbling.
And so we were talking about the videos that were released by the Pentagon. You were looking at them, and I like what you say in the book, is like the way that the craft move implies some kind of technology that is so different to what we have that the current laws of science just can't do that. But it seems a bit weird that these videos have come out and there's a, you know, it's like an established authority has said, we don't know what these things are, humans can't build them. But then society has just kind of carried on and nobody's really sort of thought, oh, wow, they're really here.
I know, it's surreal, isn't it? I think that, I think in some ways it's easy for people to, especially like lay people, you know, if you're not a pilot or you don't have that military background, or if you don't know much about planes or about, you know, military technology in general, which I would definitely have counted myself among those people. I think it can be really hard to put that stuff into context, to say that, you know, during the Nimitz incident, this object moved, what was it, like 80,000 feet in under a second. I mean, we know that that's really fast, but I also feel like that number is so large that it can be hard for people to contextualize it. And with nothing else to attach it to, I think that's the kind of detail that people can just sort of skip over really easily. There's a kind of cognitive dissonance that occurs, and you have this piece of information and you have nothing to attach it to. And so it just sort of floats away. And so, you know, I think that's what's been so much of my goal with the podcast and with the book, is to kind of help people create a framework that they can start to attach some of this to, so it doesn't just float away.
I like the way you analyze things in the book and go through the different stages of it. And it's like you say, okay, so could this be human technology, and why might it not be human, and what are we capable of? And also this thing is that these craft haven't just turned up in the last 20 years when those videos were made. They've been around for decades before that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that I think is what's so hard for people to, what I think people don't necessarily recognize. So we have these videos that the government has recognized, but the earliest of them is from 2004. What people don't recognize is that we have descriptions of these same sorts of craft and all different kinds of craft going back, you know, hundreds, and many people would argue thousands of years. And so, you know, the idea that it's Chinese drones, even if it was China, it stretches the limits of credulity even now to really think that China somehow would have made that far of a leap in technology, because we would see that. We would know. Our enemies wouldn't just sit on that information. If you had paradigm breaking technology, like, China wants to be the dominant force on the planet, just like the United States wants to be the dominant force on the planet. And if either of those countries had paradigm shattering technology at their disposal, we wouldn't be in this sort of like weird standoff that we are right now. They would make a move. And so it's, like I said, it stretches the limits of credulity even now what we're seeing could possibly be Chinese technology or from any other nation state on the planet. But even if we allow that, like, there's so much more. How do you explain 2004? I mean, that's 20 years ago now. That's a million years in terms of technological development.
What's your view on people like Robert Lazar, who say they worked on flying saucers at S4 and Area 51 and those places? Because I was talking to Grant Cameron, and he was talking about how he seemed to work out something to do with ESP. And maybe, and if they do have a craft, we don't have the ESP to control those craft anyway. We couldn't work out how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's every chance in the world. I'm personally of the camp that I think part of the reason for the extreme secrecy on the part of the United States government is that I don't think that they... it's my personal opinion that they don't have much more information than we do, even if they've been in contact with these entities. And even if they have, you know, retrieved vehicles and technology and maybe even bodies, which I think is a strong possibility. Even if that's the case, you know, you think about what experience and like what contact experiences are like for people, like what we see in the experiencer literature. And those experiences are often very strange, and they do have a telepathic nature to them if they're not entirely telepathic. People can see and experience some really unusual things that we have a really hard time explaining. And almost always, you know, when I talk to friends who are, you know, MUFON investigators and that sort of a thing, one of the things that I hear them say all the time is that a way that they weed out contact cases that are fakes is they make too much sense. Like, they're too linear. Everything's tied up with a bow, you know, and that's not how these things work. There's always something weird. There's always something that doesn't make sense. And so I feel like it's entirely possible that the government, even if they have been in contact on some level with these beings, that they don't have a strong grasp on who they're talking to, what their motivations are, what their capabilities are. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
And it's interesting, you list the, is it the Twining letter or the Twining memo, where he says that they're sure that there's something going on here and that they're not from Earth?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think people really need to go back and look at what was happening in 1947 in the summer, you know, when the UFO phenomenon in its current form kind of came into being with the Kenneth Arnold sighting and the Roswell crash. There was a lot going on in our government. They were making a lot of moves. And although to the outside they were pretending that this was nothing, it's very clear from declassified documents that have emerged since that on the inside of the government, they were taking this very, very seriously.
And I think also in that sort of time, it was just after the Second World War, and the public viewed the military in a different way they do now. And so if the military said to a member of the public, you've got to keep this secret, or if they went to the newspapers and said, listen, if you get UFO stuff, ridicule it, make these people look like idiots, then they're more likely to just accept and say, yeah, we'll do what we're told.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say we were a much more, I mean, the United States, the world was a very different place, you know, back in 1947. We were a much more collectivist culture, having come through so many major crises over the, you know, preceding decades with the world wars and the Spanish flu and all of that. We had a greater and higher regard for our government. People trusted the government a lot more than they do now. And we also had this like big bad in the form of the Soviet Union that we were all kind of coalescing against. And so I think it was a lot easier at the time for the government to tell people, like, hey, don't talk about this, and that people would be more likely to listen to that. Maybe not even necessarily out of fear, but out of, you know, a sense of responsibility and patriotism.
What's your view of them? They're kind of changing the name, aren't they, from UFOs to UAPs? Do you think they're trying to whitewash what's happening and almost say, oh no, that UFOs, that was another thing in history? If we say UAP, then don't think of aliens.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's part of the reason I stick with UFO. I don't have any problem with people who use UAP. I think it's a personal preference, but I personally feel like UAP is a way to, I mean, even just changing it from a flying object to an aerial phenomenon. Like, what's an aerial phenomenon? Are we back to swamp gas now? You know, it's confusing. And you see how it basically at every turn with this UFO program and everything within the Pentagon, they do everything that they can to kind of obfuscate and hide the truth and just muddy the waters so that it's much more difficult. You know, these unpronounceable acronyms and that sort of thing. It's just not. It's all part of the playbook of getting people to look somewhere else.
Yeah, it's like you mentioned that thing in 1952 when UFOs were over the White House and the official word was that it was just weather phenomena. Or did they really expect people to accept that?
Right? I don't understand that at all, especially, I mean, it's not like the people in D.C. didn't see the fighter jets scrambling and chasing these things. Like, that was witnessed by people all over the city. And so for them to pretend as though are our best and brightest really that easily confused by some weird weather phenomena? I don't think that's the case.
No. And you talk about Fermi and Drake and this idea of, you know, like they're saying, well, if there's life in the universe, where are they? Surely they would have found us by now. But I think it's kind of this scientific short-sightedness in a way that the level of evidence that they demand is, I don't know how to say it, it's like it's too high. They won't let the speculation come in at all, and that's stopping them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's really the thing more than anything that I'm attempting to fight back against with the work that I do. Because I think that we've gotten to this really, frankly, kind of scary place in our culture where there's a whole bunch of people, we've got about half the people, especially in the US, we've got about like half the people who won't believe anything that the government or the experts say. And then you've got the other half of the people who believe everything that the government and the experts say. And I don't know that that's either one of those things is the right approach or the best way for us to function as a society if we would like to continue to, you know, have a democratic republic. It's tough, but I think it's hard because I know how I was raised and I am very grateful for the education that I received. But I think that I was really presented, and I think schools really kind of indoctrinate people in a certain way where we teach people science in a very practical way, in the way that it is most applicable in our day-to-day lives. But we don't, which is basically within the realm of materialism. But then we teach people that there's nothing beyond that and that there's no evidence that there's anything beyond that. And so I think it becomes really easy for people to dismiss things wholesale without really looking any further into it because they have this impression that a lot more of this is settled science than it actually is, if that makes sense. So, you know, really just trying to open the door to people to show them that, you know, some of these underlying assumptions that they have about the nature of reality are not just wrong, but we've known that they're wrong for over 100 years. And so, you know, the mainstream is still scrambling to catch up because we don't really know what to replace these models and paradigms with yet. But I think just opening that door for people allows them to open their mind a little bit and consider things that they might not have considered before.
Yeah, it's that thing of being stuck in a kind of nuts and bolts universe where you have to be able to hold it in your hand physically. And this idea that consciousness may be the basis of the universe. And it's only this, like you talk about the slit experiment in the book where it's seems to be in some way consciousness might affect what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that there, you know, it's FaceTime is doomed at this point. I think that's pretty clear. And it's becoming more and more obvious that consciousness is foundational, like you said. And I think that that's a big leap for people to take because the implications of that are profound. And I think that in some ways, in our current paradigm, we've been taught that you can't really trust other people's experiences. And if you have an anomalous experience, you really can't trust yours either. That we've been taught that anything that falls outside of the realm of like the established natural normal order of things is, if you experience that, then you must be crazy. And I think that something that I'm really hopeful for is that we are reaching a tipping point with this where the mainstream science is starting to get there. And I think that the public will quickly follow of recognizing that consciousness is foundational and that the implications of that are huge, including the fact that, you know, my experience of life is likely fundamentally very different than yours. In some ways, although we all seem to be sharing this 3D space we call Earth together, that we're all living in some ways very different lives and having very different experiences of our reality. And I think just that alone allows you to open up your mind to listen to someone who may have an experience that to you sounds like utterly absurd and it's like nothing that you've ever encountered. But when you start to understand what the nature of reality actually is, it opens the door for a much greater, I guess, spectrum of things that could be. And I think it makes you a much more kind of humble and compassionate person and more willing to listen to others.
So there's an argument that some might put forward to say the aliens, the ETs can't possibly be here because the distance between stars is too great. They just wouldn't be able to get here. So how would you counter that argument?
I would just say that we don't have any business making that proclamation. You know, I think that what we're talking about with the technology that we're seeing in these craft is something that is, you know, so entirely paradigm shattering that we don't know that. Anyone who says that they know that is absurd, especially when we're talking about things that, you know, have these capabilities like transmedium travel. And, you know, they're doing this without any flight surfaces. And but the big thing is there's no sign of propulsion. So right there, we're already talking about an entirely different paradigm than for getting from point A to point B than we are aware of. And so how can you possibly, like, yes, you couldn't get there with our technology, but could you get there with whatever technology they're using? Quite possibly. I just think the universe is far too vast and we know far too little to make proclamations like that.
Yeah, I suppose if you say that, it's like saying, well, we already know all technology and all methods of propulsion, so we can be absolutely sure they can't do it because we can't do it. But it's quite an arrogant way to look at it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've been at this rocketry stuff for like 100 years, maybe less at this point. You know, so how do we even know what, you know, 10 generations, 100 generations of tech after that looks like? I just don't think we can say.
What's your view of the alien abduction phenomena?
You know, I'm not, I believe that it's absolutely true. And I believe that I know that people are experiencing this. As for what it is or what its purpose is, I really don't know. And I've had some profound experiences in my life, but I haven't had that particular experience. And so it's hard for me to know what the nature of it is. I know that people are experiencing something. I tend to believe that there is a physical component to it, that it's not just in people's minds. But I mean, it raises a lot of questions about what the motivations of these beings might be and the role that they've played in our history and potentially in our evolution and development. I mean, you have to assume that people or beings with that level of advanced technology that we're seeing, you have to assume that they don't do things randomly or without a reason. So there has to be some kind of a motivation behind these abductions. And, you know, based on what people seem to experience of a medical nature and of a sexual nature that, you know, it seems to be so frequent in the literature, you have to wonder if there's not something genetic going on there. But as for what that is or how it works, or if it's one set of entities or multiple set of entities, I feel like I'm far too early in my exploration to say for sure. And I also, I really try to just, because it's not an experience that I've had, like I'm willing to offer my speculation, but I really try to make room for experiencers to tell their own stories, because I'm not sure how valuable my judgment is at this point.
Yeah, you've got to have a mental gray area. I say gray there, but what I mean is there's some things that seem pretty much, yeah, you can accept that, but then a massive gray area where you say, okay, I'm just going to put that on the shelf. I'm not going to say it's nonsense, but I'm not going to say it's real either.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I think that's a good exercise, I think, for people to take just in general. What going through this process has really made me realize how many of my beliefs were not actually mine. I think that I know in the United States, especially, it feels like you are red or you are blue. And if you believe this, then you also believe this, 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 and this. Like these ideas come in packages. And there isn't like a ton of independent thought going on. And you see, you know, you get on Twitter on any day of the week and you see people making bold proclamations about, you know, the economy, or, I mean, even right now, this example with Twitter right now, we've got half the people saying Twitter's going to collapse tomorrow. We're saying half the people saying that Elon Musk is, you know, a genius and is saving Twitter. And the reality is that like most of us have nowhere near enough information to make that call, but everybody feels very, not just empowered, but almost pressured into having an opinion and like having a strong opinion and knowing what side you're on about stuff that like you, maybe you don't know anything about it. And so I think that it's a really good practice to, you know, be critical of your own thoughts and be critical of your own beliefs. And if you believe something is true, ask yourself, why do I think that's true? And so that's really been my attempt through this whole process, is to find the things. And I feel really good about those footholds that I've found, you know, the things that are undeniable, like the Twining memo and, you know, those sorts of things where you start to find those, you pile them up and the preponderance of evidence becomes really overwhelming. But I also try to kind of build a gate, like a floodgate against all, because there's so many possibilities and I want to keep everything on the table until there's a reason to take it off. And so I try to just be really clear on what I know or what I'm pretty sure I know versus what is just speculation.
Yes, that phrase, keep an open mind, but not so open your brains fall out.
Yes, exactly.
And I was interested to read in the book what you said about possibility of extraterrestrial life in our solar system. And one of them was, what do extremophiles tell us about that? So can you give us a little overview of them?
Yeah, absolutely. It turns out that basically there've been anywhere that we would think to look that we're like, all right, life absolutely cannot live there. We almost always end up being wrong. So there's even a kind of bacteria that can thrive inside of nuclear reactors. Just loves it in there. So there's extremophiles that can live deep within the Antarctic ice. So we have these examples, you know, in way down at the very bottom of the ocean next to these like just insanely hot water vents from coming up underneath the bottom of the ocean, you know, inside of volcanoes. We have all these examples of these sorts of organisms that can survive in all kinds of conditions, which I think really suggests to us that there is a very different, that there are many different kinds of life that are possible and that can exist in ways that we haven't considered yet and that maybe are completely different from the paradigm that we expect to see with life. And, you know, I think it's important to even argue that we might not recognize life if we saw it, if it was so different from us. Like, what about a life form that was, instead of being carbon-based, was electromagnetically based? How would we, that would break all of our concepts of what life even is. It breaks the definition of life. And yet, you know, you could conceivably have an entity that could be born and live and maybe even die that would be an electromagnetic organism. So what does that mean? You know, so I think that it's really important for people to not make assumptions about what life on other planets would be like, because we've shown that we have a poor record of guessing what life on our own planet would be like.
Yeah, it reminds me of the time, I don't know how long it goes, maybe 150 or 200 years ago, people would say they have this meteorite and it fell out of the sky, and the scientists would be like, oh, don't be ridiculous. Rocks don't fall out of the sky. That would never happen. But now we know the background to it. We know why it happens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the history of science, I mean, the history of humanity is impossible things becoming proven true. And so, you know, I think that we need to keep our minds open to what is possible. You know, we should never mistake the limits of our own understanding for the limits of what is. And I think that that's a trap that people fall into a lot.
And I was interested to read about the Viking landers finding evidence for life on Mars, but NASA just kind of wrote it off. But what happened there?
Yeah, that was a crazy story. So they had signs of, what they had signs of was respiration, that there was some sort of, there were markers of organic respiration. So not necessarily, this was probably like this could have been just a one cell organism, or it could have been a multicellular organism. I'm not suggesting that there was like, you know, something burrowing around down there, but they did in the soil samples have some markers of organic respiration. And these were in places that were like, I forget exactly how far apart they were, but I think they were a couple of miles apart. They weren't right next to each other. And they were getting the same markers in both places. But that was all that they got, was just this sign that there was some sort of organic respiration going on in the soil. And because of that, because they didn't have anything else kind of stronger to point to, they said they basically made the call that this was not a sign of life, even though they can't explain. We're not aware of anything else that would create these markers of organic respiration. So I think that was, you know, another example of like, if we found life, would we necessarily recognize that we had found life, or would there be enough evidence for us to call it life? Would it, if it was too dissimilar from us, would we not recognize it? And so, you know, I find that story very, very interesting, because it's hard to explain what could have caused, they still don't have an explanation for what caused it.
It sounds like they don't have that gray area. It sounds like they got to this point and just said, nope, it's definitely not a sign of life. But they didn't sort of put it to one side and said, okay, it's a gray area. We don't know yet. We haven't got enough information.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know why it is that way, to be honest with you. It just doesn't seem like it would be that big of a deal to just say, hey, you know, we're not going to call it, we're not going to say for sure that we found life on Mars until we actually find life on Mars, but we found this sign of life on Mars, and that's pretty cool. I mean, it feels like that would have at least warranted a press conference, but apparently not.
And so you also talk about this question of, are UFOs humans from the future, which is something I doubt. What's your view on that?
I'm not sure. I will say that that's one that I've struggled with a lot. It's one of my least favorite theories. I give it more credence than I used to. And I think that that might just be me getting more used to the idea. I think it's tough because time travel is just a tough one to contemplate. I think that there are a lot of other models that would work better. And it's complicated to address time travel for a couple of reasons. One is that we don't know that it's possible. However, if it is possible, it's probably happening all the time, right? Like once somebody, if humans ever cross that threshold in the future where we develop time travel, then we have to assume that they're traveling back to now at some point, right? Like if it ever happens, it's happening. But the question is it possible? Like, is it even possible for us to time travel? And we don't know that it is. We know one way to time travel, which is that, you know, the kind of thing you see in sci-fi movies where, you know, like Interstellar and that sort of thing, where the astronauts, you know, because of relativity, they're going so fast, or they go by such a massive object during their travels that, you know, there's time dilation. And so, you know, just a couple of minutes or days has gone on from them, but then back on Earth, it's been, you know, many decades have passed in that same amount of time. And so we do actually know how to go hypothetically. We know how to go forward in time, because we would just need to figure out a way to get somebody to go fast enough, essentially, to get that to happen. But we don't know how to go backwards in time. And we're not sure that we can. There's nothing in physics necessarily to disallow that, except for the second law of thermodynamics, which is basically the reason that if you stir, like if you put a few drops of ink into a glass of water and you stir it up, the second law of thermodynamics is the reason that you can't get that ink back out of the water. It's been distributed through the water. So that sort of shows you that there's a directionality to time. And there's arguments against that as well. But long story short, we don't even know that time travel is possible. And the implications of time travel in terms of the timeline and reality is just like such a headache that I think I personally, it's not my favorite. But, you know, I keep it on the table because I haven't been able to rule it out yet.
And also humans can make such a mess of things. If they did get time travel in the future, they'd probably make a mess of it and we would have spotted them by now.
Exactly. I mean, I think we'd have much bigger problems than the Berenstain Bears or the Berenstain Bears, whatever that mandala thing is. The implications for the time stream, I mean, how much can you change it? It just feels untenable. You know, it feels like things would start to break down pretty quickly. That's just my gut instinct. I don't feel like I know enough about time travel to say for sure. And I will say that anytime I watch a time travel movie, I get very confused. So that could also be my prejudice against it.
So you get to a point in the book where you talk about the interdimensional hypothesis. So could you give us a basic idea of what that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interdimensional hypothesis is really interesting. And it's really complex also, because there's, you know, going into this sort of realizing that, first of all, we haven't been able to prove that other dimensions even exist, although some of our science and different kinds of models depend on the idea that it does. We can't, like string theory, we can't prove it. And there's also lots of different models for what an interdimensional reality might look like. So, like, for instance, in string theory, I believe there's like exactly 11 dimensions, or maybe it's 12, I can't remember. But there's a limited amount, there's like an exact number of dimensions. And so, and that's kind of the difference between, like, the way to think about that is that they're dimensions that build on top of each other. So, you know, in the way that the third dimension exists within the fourth dimension, you know, then the fourth dimension would exist within the fifth dimension. And it can be really hard to conceptualize what that would be. And there's lots of interesting resources out there for people if they want to explore that further. But, you know, that's kind of like this stackable dimension model. And then there's also, you know, something like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which would assume that basically any time that a quantum system, and a quantum system could be a cell, or it could be a storm, or it could be a solar system, or it could be a person. Any time that any kind of change, or like basically the idea that anything that can happen does happen somewhere. And so there's basically an entire universe that's built out around every single possibility and iteration of everything that could have possibly happened. And I find that one to be a little bit untenable as well. That just feels too much. But once again, that me feeling like it's not possible does not mean it's not possible. So it's on the table. And then there's just the idea also of just like other universes in general, kind of like the classic alternate universe, that there's different timelines or time streams that may exist in the same place as we are, occupying the same place, but in a different dimension. So there's a lot of different ways that a multiverse of some kind could exist. And, you know, like with time travel, if other dimensions exist, which we can't prove, but we have a lot of evidence that they do, and if it's possible to travel between them, we have to assume that it's happening, right? Because why wouldn't it be? What would be stopping it? If it can happen, what would stop it from happening? And so if that's, I think that that is a pretty enticing hypothesis for a lot of people, because it kind of opens up the world to this vast tapestry of strangeness that we see, you know, this vast pantheon of different kinds of beings and entities and experiences and all of that, an interdimensional model of the universe kind of makes it more clear to us how that might be possible.
And it's one of the things that abductees kind of talk about, and when it gets to high strangeness, that it seems like there's something interdimensional happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that things are so weirdly familiar to us, you know, just the fact that we see so many humanoids and things that we recognize and technology that looks kind of like something that we might have seen before, but not quite. I mean, the interdimensional hypothesis definitely would allow for that kind of weirdness. And so I think that's something that we definitely need to take a closer look at.
We get closer to this idea of consciousness being the central part of it all. I feel that interdimensional idea is so weird that this consciousness thing is so weird. And I was talking to Ray Hernandez on an interview recently, and he's got a new book out. Well, he's got several books out, and it kind of links all this different stuff together, like near-death experiences and UFOs and psi abilities and reincarnation. What's your view of all that linkage going on?
I think there's definitely something there. I as you get more into this stuff, it becomes harder and harder to deny. To be honest, like my podcast is about UFOs, but almost all the reading that I'm doing right now is about consciousness and psi phenomena and that sort of thing. I really enjoy points of convergence, the Point of Convergence podcast with Exo Academian, aka Darren King. He's a friend of mine, and I think that he has done a really interesting job of taking kind of like an academic approach to kind of the full spectrum of phenomena that we kind of put under the umbrella of the UFO phenomena. Some people don't put it under that umbrella, but in the UFO community, they do. You know, and kind of looking at all of that stuff at once and saying, okay, so what does this tell us about the nature of our reality and the nature of these entities that we're interacting with? And I think he's done like a really interesting and thorough job of analyzing that information. But that's where actually season two, and it will be actually book three of the series at that point, is going to dive into next year, is going to be really looking at these different models of reality and of consciousness and how all of this integrates with both the UFO phenomenon, but also this much wider spectrum of psi phenomenon, you know, from telepathy and, you know, the persistence of life after death and consciousness and all these things. I think I think there's going to be a real, what I'm hopeful to see is that the UFO phenomenon is going to be the thing that brings about a real renaissance in our understanding of reality.
Because there have been times I've heard people during an abduction would say to the ETs, how can you do this to me? You've no right. And the ETs say, yeah, but you agreed to this before you were born.
Yeah, I know. I think that's so, so interesting. I wonder about that. You know, I think that there is something that I've found about my exploration that I've heard echoed from a lot of other people who have explored this topic and who are the experiencers themselves, is that as you start to kind of, as the universe sort of grabs you by the hair through synchronicities and, you know, anomalous experiences and that sort of thing, and starts pulling you down this path. And as that starts to happen, you start to see your entire life differently. I started to kind of unravel a lot of different threads of meaning in my own life that didn't make sense at the time, that make sense now under, you know, kind of in this new paradigm of my life. And so I think that, I don't have any solid proof of this, but I have a feeling that there is a certain amount of consent, like pre-consent, that's given in terms of the experiences that we have in our life, because they do seem to be very specially tailored for us and for our developmental needs.
And so there's another theory as well, the ultra-terrestrial hypothesis, which is that basically ETs are from this planet.
Yes. And Personally, it's actually my favorite. I actually don't think that it totally explains the full spectrum of phenomena. And I suspect that what we're looking at is probably a combination of all of the above, or at least some of the above. But I do think that the ultra-terrestrial hypothesis is overlooked far too often, and that there's a lot of evidence from, you know, everything from religious texts and myths to, you know, modern day tales of Sasquatch that tell us that there are, I mean, even just the fact that so many UFOs are seen underwater, and that the government really doesn't like to talk about that or mention that part. I think it tells us that there is a distinct possibility that there is an intelligent presence on this planet that we have not fully reckoned with.
And you feel this might be linked to ancient aliens? Because I don't know a lot about ancient aliens. I've never watched the TV show.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that, so when we look at, for me, what it comes down to is really just the timeline. I'm not necessarily one of these, the aliens built the pyramids types. You know, I don't rule anything out ever, but that's not where I go in particular. What I'm really interested in is evidence of a major cataclysm on Earth that really both kicked off and then ended the last ice age, the Younger Dryas, which only lasted for about 1,000 years. But there is now overwhelming evidence that there was a catastrophic event on this planet at that time. It killed off over 40% of the megafauna in North America in what looks to be a matter of weeks or months, not over a long period of time. It happened very, very quickly. And the other piece of evidence that I find really intriguing is that we have sites like, in particular, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which has been conclusively dated at 12,000 years old, the oldest parts of it, which is right around the time, like right at the end of the last ice age. And this is a megalithic site that's on par with anything else that you'd see in the world. And the reason that we still have it and that it's even findable is because it was intentionally buried for reasons that we do not understand. But it's kind of like a Stonehenge looking like place, but much more intricate. And it shows a very clear understanding of things like descriptive geometry and advanced astronomy and art and controversially and very hard to prove, but some people would even say written language. And this is over 6,000 years before what we thought were like the earliest megaliths were ever being built. And this is, you know, right at the end of the last ice age. And this is the dating on that is very mainstream. That's not up for debate at all. We all agree that that's when this thing was built. And so the question then becomes, if the planet about 12,000 years ago and for about 1,000 years before that was maybe not entirely unlivable, but a very hostile place, and we see a huge decline in species and the overall population of species across the planet at this time, what are the chances that humans came out of that period with that kind of understanding and the marker and these markers of high civilization? You know, it hints that perhaps there was something that came before that, and that there could have been pockets of human civilization in the much deeper past. And if that's the case, it does call into question our entire timeline of humanity. If there were pre-ice age civilizations that got wiped out, what were they like? We don't know anything about them. And so that's really interesting. And I don't necessarily think that those cultures needed to be seeded by some sort of a non-human intelligence. We simply don't have enough evidence of them at all to say anything like that. But I do think it's a possibility, and it would explain some things. So it's a really interesting topic, and I'm completely obsessed with it. I don't know 100% if I say that it's you know, that there's signs that aliens, you know, had a hand in early human civilization, but there are a lot more questions there that I think that we've only just begun to explore.
So can you tell us about your podcast? What's it called? Where people can find it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's also called The UFO Rabbit Hole. Makes it very easy. And you can find it anywhere that you listen to podcasts. It's a structured narrative-based podcast, and it is, you know, I always say that it's accessible for noobs, anybody who's new to the subject and doesn't know anything about it. I basically created something that I wished existed when I started, because there's so many amazing podcasts and so much great content out there on this subject. But for somebody who's approaching it for the first time, it can be really kind of overwhelming and like, where do I start? And so I created my podcast to be an on-ramp. So it's like, start on episode one, you've never heard anything before, and go all the way through. But I'm also really proud to say that there are a lot of people within the UFO community who have been studying this for years who are also fans of the podcast. So it's not, this is in no way like a 101 level approach. I really, my goal is that by the end of season one, and definitely by the end of season two, that people who have followed along will have about as in-depth of a understanding of the phenomenon and where we are with it as kind of somebody who's been obsessively spending all their time on this like I do, and I know like so many of us do.
And this book that we've been talking about is book one. So have you got like a whole ton of books mapped out and you just need to write them?
Yes, absolutely. So my podcast, because it's all scripted, what I basically do is this first book is the first 10 episodes. So I've been kind of writing a book and a podcast at the same time. And so each book will kind of chunk about 10 or so episodes together, and I'll just continue to release them in that way. Because my goal is really just to take this information and to make it available to people in as many different formats as possible. Because, I mean, it's absurd to me because it takes over my whole life and I listen to podcasts constantly, but like there's a lot of people who don't listen to podcasts. And so I wanted to make something that was accessible for people, and also for people who listen, you know, I've made the transcripts available right when I publish them so that people can kind of like, and all of my sources and all like bonus materials and everything is all included that people can check out. People have really liked that and have asked me to compile it into a book. And so I went ahead and did that. So it makes it a little easier for kind of some of the denser sections where I go into a lot of different theories at once for people to go back and to check my sources. I tell people to check my work all the time. If I make a mistake, I will own up to it. I'm not afraid to be wrong. And I think that that's something that we all need to do, is be a little less afraid to be wrong. Being wrong is fine. I'm really excited about the book, and it's kind of the culmination of what I've been working towards over the last year.
It sounds like a lot of hard work.
It's been a lot. It's been a labor of love, though. I think I've truly found a sweet spot with my passions, the things that I care the most about, and also the kind of work that I most like to do. You know, like I said, I'm a brand director. I work in, you know, content and communications and messaging, and, you know, this is the kind of stuff I do all day long. And so it's kind of been a really natural fit for me, and I'm honestly having just the time of my life doing it.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. I'll put links in the show notes to your podcast and your book, and it's been great talking to you.
It's been wonderful talking to you too. Thank you so much for having me.
And that was an interview with Kelly Chase about her book, The UFO Rabbit Hole, Book 1. And if you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 230 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And this link is in the show notes. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And my Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.